As we finish up, he takes my arm. Erin, you don't have to do this, you know. I can go down alone. You can stay on the boat, and I'll be back in about 15 minutes. That's all it'll take, honey. He pushes a wet strand of hair behind my ear. No, it's okay. I'm fine. I smile. I can do this. And if I don't see it for myself, I'll be imagining worse anyway. I say, my voice distant, slightly off key again. He nods. He knows me too well to disagree. I'm coming. He slides on his mask, signals descend, and slips beneath the surface. I place my mask on slowly, securely, letting it suck hard against my cheeks. I can't afford any mishaps today. I take my last breath of sweet, fresh air and follow him under. It's clearer down here than it was last time. Crystal clear blue, high-definition blue. Mark is waiting for me just below the surface, picked out in nature program resolution, a living thing suspended in an ocean of nothing. He gestures to descend, and we let out our buoyancy. Our descent is steady. I look up at the huge waves crashing above us. It's so eerily still down here. Seen from underneath, the cresting waves appear forged from metal as they glint in the sun. Huge sheets of burnished aluminium. Everything is fine. Everything is fine up until we hit 10 meters. Mark jerkily stops and signals for me to hold position. I freeze. Something's wrong. Blood suddenly bursts through my veins at a rate of knots, pumping faster than ever around my body. Why are we stopping? Is there something in the water? I'm careful not to move, but my eyes search in every direction for what it could be. I can't see it. Should we get back up to the boat, or is it fine? Mark signals, "It's okay," back to me. Okay, then what? Why hold? He signals to me again, "Hold." He signals, "Be calm." Be calm is never a good sign. Then he signals, "Look down." Oh, God. Oh, Gody, God, God, why look down? Why? I don't want to look down. I don't want to look down, Mark. I shake my head. No. No, not doing it. He reaches out and takes my arm. He signals, "It's okay," again. His eyes. "It's fine, Erin." I nod. I'm calm. All right, I can do this. I can do this. I breathe in deep, a cool, crisp, chemical breath, and look down. It's beautiful. Papers caught in a slow-motion dance hang in the water all around us, half-sunk, half-floating, beautiful. Then through the gaps between the papers, I see it below us. About 30 meters below us on the seabed. A plane. Not a commercial plane. A small plane. A private jet, perhaps. I see it clearly below. One wing disconnected, broken off in the sand beneath. A great gaping breach in its main hull. And darkness within. I breathe out, hanging motionless in the water. I breathe in, slow, calm. I look to the door, the aeroplane's door. It's sealed. The door is sealed. Oh. Oh, shit. I feel the panic rise. I feel it fizz through my muscles, through my arms, through my heart. The clenching, the seizing. Fuck. Oh, my fucking God. There are people in there. The trapdoor in my mind bursts wide open and the panic spills out all over me. Images flash through my mind. I can see rows of silent people safely strapped in the dark below us. Their faces, jaws broken mid-scream. Stop. I command myself, this is not real. Stop. But it is though, isn't it? It is real. They'll be in there. I know they will. They can't have got out. They didn't even try. Why didn't they even try? I realize I've stopped breathing. I gasp in a breath. The gasps come fast in quick succession. Panicked pulls on life. grasping. Oh shit, oh shit, oh shit. I look up, the sun dancing silver above us, 10 meters up. I have to get out of the water. Now. I flail out of Mark's grasp, kicking as hard as I can, up, up and away from the plane, from the death. A hand grabs my ankle and I jolt to a stop as it pulls hard, yanks me down. I can't get away. It's Mark. Mark holding me down in the water, protecting me from rising too fast, from hurting myself. I know it's for my own good, but I don't want it. I need to get out the fucking water right now. The surface is still about 8 meters above us. I suck in breaths as I struggle to get free, free from him. He clambers up me to eye level and seizes me by my shoulders, strong and steady, trying to muffle the panic, staunch it. He catches my gaze. Stop, Erin. Stop, his eyes say. Breathe. He's got me. It's okay. He's got me. I'm okay. I breathe. I relax into his hold. Calm. Calm. I'm okay. The panic sucks back into its hole and the trapdoor slams shut behind it. Stillness. I breathe. I signal okay. Mark nods, satisfied. He loosens his grip. I'm okay, but I'm not going down there. There's no way on earth I am going down there. I signal up. I'm going up. He looks at me for a while before he replies. He signals, okay. Then, you, up. He's still going down, alone. I squeeze his arms and he releases me. I watch him descend as I kick up slowly. A controlled ascent. Now the panic has dissipated. He disappears into the murky darkness as I rise. Once I hit the surface, I remove my tank immediately in the water and haul it onto the boat. I strip off my suit and leave it like a husked skin on the floor. I slump there, shivering and wheezing, struggling to catch my breath, elbows on my knees as the tears start to well in my eyes. Images flash across the back of my closed eyelids. Their faces. The passengers. Distorted, distended. The terror. I slam my fist down hard onto my legs. Pain flashes through my body. Anything to stop the images. I get up and pace the deck. Think about something else. What does it mean, Erin? Yes, think about that. Concentrate on that. What does it mean? It means the bag was on a plane, and the plane crashed. A storm in the South Pacific. Something happened, and they had nowhere to land. We're about 1 hour by air to Tahiti. I guess they couldn't make it there. Or maybe they didn't want to land in Tahiti. It's obviously a private plane. A private jet. They had money. Other than the bag money, obviously. Perhaps they wanted to stay away from public airports. I think about the diamonds, the money, the gun. Perhaps they thought they could outrun the storm. But they didn't. I look at my watch. Mark must be in there by now. With them. Stop it, Erin. I turn my mind to the logistics of the flight. Where were they going? I'm going to need to look some stuff up once we're back. I rummage through the boat locker until I find what I'm looking for. A pad and pencil. Right. I know what I need to do. What I need to focus on. Not the plane down there. Mark's got that covered. I note down, flight paths over French Polynesia. God, I wish I'd noted down the tail number or something from down there. I'm sure Mark will. I jot down, plane type, aircraft tail number, max speed, and distance achievable non-stop. Planes can only travel so far without refueling. We can try and work out where they might have been heading. I doubt the flight was logged, but we can search online and see if anyone is missing. At least now our question has been answered. What we have found is flotsam. Our bag was most certainly not deliberately jettisoned. Somehow that canvas bag made its way along with those bundles of paper, out of the plane's breached hull and up into the Polynesian sunshine. But, and this is a big one, technically, what we have is neither flotsam nor jetsam. This is not a shipwreck. This is a plane crash. What we have is a big bag of evidence from an underwater aviation incident. I take a shuddery breath of cool tropical air. Our honeymoon feels a million miles away, and yet just within reach. If only we could... Mark breaks through the waves on my starboard side. He fins towards the boat, his expression blank, controlled. For the first time, I truly appreciate how useful his masked emotions actually are. I think if I ever saw him truly scared, then I'd know for sure that we were done for. He drags himself up the ladder at the stern of the boat, exhausted. "Water, please," he says as he jiggles his tank off onto the deck. He peels off his suit, discards it like mine, and drops heavily onto the teak seating. I fetch a water bottle from the cooler box and hand it across to him. His eyes are tight in the sunlight, brow tensed against the glare. "You all right?" he asks. He's watching me, concerned. Yeah, I'm fine. Sorry, I'm not sure how to finish that sentence, so I stop. "No, it's fine. God, it's good you came up." He takes a long pull on the water bottle and looks out over the waves, his wet hair dripping slowly onto his bare shoulders. "Fucking hell," he says. I wait, but he doesn't continue. "Are they in there?" I ask. I have to ask. I have to know. "Yeah," he says. He takes another long swig of water. "Two pilots up front, three passengers, that I could see. One of them was a woman, the rest men." He looks out again at the waves, his jaw tight. "Fucking hell." I realize too late that I've echoed him. I don't know what else to say. "They weren't good people, Aaron," he says, looking at me now. What the fuck does that mean? I want to know more. I want to know everything he saw, but it doesn't seem right to ask. He's processing. I wait for him to tell me. But nothing comes. He drinks more. His words still hang in the air. I try and catch them before they disappear. "What do you mean they weren't good people, Mark?" "The things they had with them, down there. They weren't good people. Don't feel too sad, is all I mean." With that, he stands, grabs a towel and wipes his face, rubs his hair. I realize that's probably the most I'll get from him now. And I don't want to linger too long on the thought of the people down there. I'm trying my hardest to stay focused as it is. I change the subject. Well, sort of. "It's Flotsam, Mark." He stares at me blankly for a moment. I think he'd forgotten all about the bag until now. I continue. "Well, sort of, Flotsam. Lost by accident in an emergency. It can be claimed by the owners. But you've just met the owners, and I don't think they'll be claiming it any time soon, will they?" My stab at dark humour. I'm not sure it sounded quite right. No, they won't," he says it flatly. I move on quickly. "Mark, did you get the plane's tail number? Anything we can use to identify them, who they were? Anything helpful?" He pulls the dive slate off his tank strap and hands it to me. The plane make, model, and tail number. Of course he got it. "They're Russian," he says as I jot the slate information down in my notepad and wipe it clean again. I look up. "How do you know that?" "There were Russian snack packets." "Right," I nod slowly. "Listen, Aaron, you said no one will claim the bag. Does that mean you're suggesting we don't report this? We don't report a plane crash?" He's scowling at me. "Shit. Yes. I thought that's what we were both suggesting, weren't we? To keep the shiny, pretty diamonds and the free money, to pay off our mortgage and have a family, right? Or am I crazy? Maybe I am crazy." My mind flits to the people below us. The dead people, rotting in the water. The bad people. Should we keep the bad people's money? Yes, that is what I'm suggesting, I say to Mark. He nods slowly, processing what that means. I continue, carefully. I am suggesting that we get back to the hotel, find out if they've been reported missing, and if anyone is missing them at all, then we forget it all, drop it back here. But if not, if they've just evaporated into thin air, then yes, I say we keep the bag. We found it floating in the sea, Mark. We keep it and we use it for a better purpose than I'm sure it was meant for. He looks at me. I can't quite tell through the blaze of sun what his expression means. Okay, he says. Let's find out who they are. Chapter 16. Tuesday, September the 13th. Flight paths. It turns out there's a live online feed of every registered airborne flight in the world. I'm watching it now as different-sized purple triangles flicker across a lo-fi black and yellow map of the world, a real-life version of the video game Asteroids. A brief touch of the cursor arrow over each of the larger triangles displays its flight number, its origin, and its destination. The smaller triangles, private planes, jets, simply display their craft type. Gulfstream G550, Falcon 5X, Global 6000. Our plane was, and still is, I suppose, a Gulfstream G650. I look up its specifications online. The G650 can fly 8,000 miles without refueling. That's pretty much the distance from London to Australia. That's a really long way for a small business jet. Its top speed is Mach 0.925, transonic. That means traveling at nearly the speed of sound. The speed of sound. It would have been a short flight if they'd made it wherever they were going. I guess they thought they could outrun the storm. I look up the most common causes of small craft accidents. Wikipedia tells me, severe instability can occur at transonic speeds. Shockwaves move through the air at the speed of sound. When an object such as an aircraft also moves near to the speed of sound, these shockwaves build up in front of the plane's nose to form a single, very large shockwave. During transonic flight, the plane must pass through this large shockwave, as well as contend with the instability caused by air moving faster than sound over parts of the wing and slower in other parts. That might have been it, mightn't it? They just hit the storm at that speed and it knocked them out of the sky. I guess we'll never know. I need to look up the tail number next. R-RWOA. I'm hoping it's a similar system to the car registration system. Hopefully there's some kind of database online. After a couple of searches, it becomes evident that the R-R element of the registration is the country prefix. Registered in Russia. Mark was right. People do get quite nationalistic about their choice of snacks, it's true. I check the National Aviation Database for Russia, and somehow it works. It just works. The details come up. There's nothing solid, of course. It was registered in 2015 to a company called Aegis Consultants. Possibly the least glamorous company name that I've ever heard. It sounds a bit like a recruitment company in Basildon. Except small businesses in Basildon can't usually afford $60 million planes. Yeah, that's how much that plane was worth. Over $60 million. Our house is the most expensive thing we own, and it's only worth $1.5 million. And we haven't even paid off the mortgage yet. I'm starting to wonder if, whoever these people are, they'd even miss the contents of the bag. It's obviously not their main business, if it's even a sideline. But it does make me wonder if they've been missed. There must be someone out there looking. $60 million planes, their crews and their owners don't just vanish. They leave a hole, don't they? Aegis Consultants is a corporation registered in Luxembourg. Which makes sense, I suppose. I don't know much about Luxembourg, but I do know it's a tax haven. I'm pretty sure Aegis is a shell company. Mark explained them to me once. Shell companies are ghost companies set up to make transactions, but the companies have no assets or services in and of themselves. They're empty shells. I reopen the flight path feed and scroll over our airspace. The empty black section of screen over French Polynesia. It's completely blank at the moment. No planes overhead. There won't be scout planes this far from the mainland, and as the helicopter pilot told us, helicopters can only island hop out this far. Helicopter fuel tanks aren't large enough to fly all the way back to the mainland unless they refuel on a plane ship. If someone is looking for this plane, then somewhere between America and Asia is a pretty big search area to cover. But if we had some idea where they were headed or where they departed from, we might be able to work out who they were. The triangle nearest our island on the flight map is currently hovering equidistant between Hawaii and us. A tap reveals it to be a passenger jet from LAX to Australia. Looking at the live feed, it's clear that planes do fly over the vast expanse of the North and South Pacific Ocean. I always thought airlines tried to avoid it because there was nowhere to land during emergencies. Isn't it always better to be over land if something goes wrong? At least then there's a chance of landing. Better to fly around the endless water than over it. But it turns out there are still a few trans-Pacific flight paths in the sky above us. People being ferried to and fro, although clearly there's less air traffic here than over the bustling Atlantic, which is alive right now with color, planes like swarming purple ants crawling across the screen. Not much directly over us, though. Over us, it's mostly commercial airliners from LAX or San Francisco, heading to Sydney, Japan, and New Zealand. Then I catch sight of another triangle, higher up on the map than the others. It looks like it's come from Russia. I scroll over it, yes. A Gulfstream G550 private jet. Another one. It's heading the opposite way from most of the flights over the Pacific. It's heading left to right, over to Central or North America. I can't tell which just yet. It's hard to know where to even start to look for these people, these ghost people. Google offers no information on missing flights over the past few days, beyond a story about a missing light aircraft in Wyoming. I think I can safely say this is not our guys. Some weekend hobbyist, I suppose, who got carried away, or a crop farmer who made a fatal mistake. I'm sure that mystery will solve itself. Either way, there's nothing to be found online about our missing plane. I search for private airports in Russia. There are loads, of course. And I'm guessing if you've got money, air traffic control can probably keep you off the grid there if need be. Perhaps that's true anywhere. I'm suddenly reminded of the people we saw in the first class lounge at Heathrow. The millionaires who didn't look like millionaires. Why weren't they flying in their own planes? Or chartering? A quick search reveals that chartering a private jet from London to LAX costs around £4,000 for one person on an empty leg flight, and £30,000 for the whole plane. A standard first-class ticket, without using any points, is about £9,000 round trip. If you're rich enough to fly first class, why not just hire a jet? Hell, why not buy one? Maybe they're not savvy enough. Maybe they're not rich enough. Maybe the people in that lounge weren't even paying for their own tickets. Either way, it all feels very different now. First class doesn't seem quite so impressive somehow. It all feels a bit, well, silly in comparison. These ghost people live in a world that, up until now, I had no idea existed. A world I wouldn't even begin to know how to access. I'm not sure we're going to find anything that these people don't want us to find out. I mean, let's face it, I'm not a spy. I don't have access to databases. Resources. But then, that does give me an idea. Maybe Mark would be able to recognize them. He saw them, after all. He saw their faces, albeit in pretty unnatural circumstances. I try to imagine what he must have seen. Those corpses swaying like reeds, bloated in the water. Don't go there, Erin. Mark, if I showed you some pictures, would you be able to recognize any of them? The pilots, those passengers, the two men and the woman? He takes a moment. Why? Did you come up with something? I'm not sure yet, but do you think you could? I tap away at the keyboard, trying to find what I'm looking for. Yeah. Yeah, I do. I'm pretty sure I'll never forget what they look like. That's the first time he's talked about them that way. As if he, too, is haunted by them. I sometimes forget he feels things, too. Does that sound strange? But by that, I mean, I sometimes forget he has fears, too. Weaknesses. I try so hard to suppress mine, I forget that he must be doing the same. He sits down next to me on the edge of the bed so he can see the screen. I've pulled up the Interpol website. I click on the Wanted Persons tab, top right. There are currently 182 wanted persons listed. 182 photographs for Mark to look through. I think it's fairly obvious what we're dealing with now. I know $2 million is fuck all to people who can afford a $60 million jet, but I have a feeling this bag isn't the sum total of their business. Mark looks up at me. Seriously? It can't hurt, can it? Scroll through, check. I hand him the laptop and leave him to it. I grab my phone and go out onto the decking. I want him to check the FBI wanted list next, and the British National Crime Agency list after. I find them easily with a quick Google search on my phone. Rows of FBI mugshots load up just like the Interpol site. They're a seedy-looking bunch. But then, to be fair, I suppose you could put a picture of Mark's mum on an FBI watch list and she'd somehow manage to look seedy. I glance back at him through the glass door, his face lit up by the screen's glow. It can't hurt to check, can it? Even if he sees nothing, at least we've tried. And we will find something eventually. Or he'll have to go back down there. We need to find some clue as to who they are, or we'll just have to go back, leave the money down there, and forget the whole thing. I suddenly remember the iPhone. It's still in the gun box in the bag, which I've hidden at the top of the wardrobe behind the spare hotel pillows, right at the back. Mark's already vetoed using it, even turning it on. He insists we should chuck it. But it could save us so much time if we just used it. Just once. The battery's dead. I know this because I've already tried pressing the power button. I tried it while he was in the shower earlier, but no power. If I could just charge it, then we'd know immediately who they were. We could stop searching. I look at him again through the glass. His face is concentrated, focused. He's worried about culpability, of course. I know he is. He's thinking ahead. He's thinking practically. If something happens, if we have to go to court, if we turn the iPhone on, it'll be solid evidence that we have the bag. It'll pick up signal, and the account will show when and where. Even if we put it all back underwater, in the plane, under the sea, it'll show up on some network server somewhere that it was receiving a signal after the crash. It'll prove someone found the crash, the dead people, all of it, and told no one, hid the evidence. But then again, it might just all be fine. I might just turn the phone on and find out whose it is, and that could be it. I mean, if I make sure it's on airplane mode, it won't pick up a signal at all, and that should be fine. No mobile phone record, no evidence. I can definitely do this. I can fix this. I know I can. I'll charge it tonight. Chapter 17. Wednesday, September the 14th. The phone. Something very, very bad has happened. Last night, Mark went to a private squash lesson over in the hotel complex. He needs the distraction. The stress is getting to him, and I suggested it would be a good outlet. Plus, he loves squash. It's really sort of sanctioned shouting for men, isn't it? While he was out, I took the opportunity to unplug the trouser press that's hidden inside the closet, and plug in the iPhone from the bag using our spare charger. I plugged it in, checked it was on silent, and slid it down the side of the press in case Mark looked in the closet. I woke up earlier than usual this morning, the anticipation of what I was going to do weighing on my mind. I had to wait until Mark had finished his breakfast and got in the shower to slip back into the closet and unplug it. It hadn't turned on by itself. I wasn't sure if that was something that happened automatically. For all I know, it could be broken. And then where would I be? I pocketed it and replaced the spare charger in our suitcase and replugged the presser. What I need is some more time by myself. Just half an hour or so to check the phone. But it's hard thinking of excuses to spend time alone on your honeymoon, isn't it? Nothing seems important enough to be a credible distraction. I think of Holly's release 2 days ago. It makes sense that I'd need to Skype Phil to sort out logistics on filming with her as soon as we're back, now that we've missed her actual release. That definitely seems like a good enough reason to leave the room on my own for a while. I tell Mark I'm going out to Skype my crew. I tell Mark I'll need an Ethernet connection for the internet. It'll make the call signal stronger, the picture quality better. And rather conveniently, I'll need to go to the hotel's business center for that. He offers to come too, but I say it'll be too boring for him, and maybe a bit weird for Phil and Duncan, and I'll be super quick. Back before he knows it, I promise. He seems satisfied. I suggest he look through the Interpol missing persons section today too, just in case. You never know. But then, I do know. I know they won't be there. These people won't be reported missing. They just won't. The business center is a small room with a large cream PC and a boxy printer unit. There's a conference table in the center of it, taking up almost all the floor space. I can't imagine the room has ever been used for an actual business meeting. Perhaps they use it for staff meetings. I give the corners of the room a cursory glance, high up along the coving. No cameras. That's good. What I'm doing is going to look odd, and I don't want video evidence of me doing it. You know, just in case it all comes out wrong. I log on to the computer and pull up the search screen. I'm ready. I've been reading up on what to do all morning. I pull the iPhone out of my pocket and push the power button. The screen floods with white light, followed by the tiny Apple logo. I'm going to have to switch to airplane mode as soon as the locked screen comes up. I wait, holding my breath, while it slowly loads itself. How long has it been turned off? Does it take longer to load the longer it's been off, I wonder? Probably not. Then the screen flashes up. Not the locked screen. There's no locked screen. No password. Just apps. Straight to apps. My God. No password. That's ridiculous. Who does that in this day and age? I hastily swipe up the quick access control center and tap the little airplane button. Safe. It would have still been possible to switch to airplane mode from a locked screen, which is exactly what I had expected to be doing. My plan had been to bypass the locked screen. Apparently it's fairly easy to do, according to the internet, but I don't need to do any of that now. The owner obviously wasn't too worried about people checking his phone. I suppose putting it in a case along with a handgun is probably security enough. My heart is hammering. I have access to everything. There aren't many app icons. Some I recognize, some look foreign, but it's mainly just the in-house apps. No additions, no Candy Crush. I tap on mail. An inbox bounces up. All the emails are in Russian. Shit. I thought something like this might happen. Okay, well, I guess they were Russian. Anyway, it's an alphabet I can't read. Okay, the easiest way to do this is to copy and paste into Google Translate. Hardly elegant, but again, let me stress, I am not a spy. I can't copy and paste the emails from this phone directly into Translate because I can't let it go online. And I definitely can't forward them to my email account and do it from there. I turn to the hotel computer and load Google Russia, and type in the email provider that the emails have been sent to. It's the Russian email provider Yandex. The landing page means nothing to me. The writing is a mess of angular nonsense I don't understand. But in the top right-hand corner is a familiar box containing space for a username and password. I type the email address on the phone into the first box and click the illegible squiggles below the password. Password reset. I fill it out and wait. I stare at the phone. Oh, bugger. I'm not going to be able to get the reset email, obviously. What a fucking moron. I'm not online. The reset email won't get through. Why the fuck didn't I think of that? Idiot. Okay. Hang on. I can turn Wi-Fi on while still in airplane mode, of course. Mark showed me how to do it on the flight over so we could use the in-flight Wi-Fi. Then I won't pick up any network signal. It won't be traceable. I can connect to the hotel Wi-Fi on the phone, collect the reset email, and then reset the password. Yes. I run through it quickly, connect the phone to the hotel Wi-Fi network, and wait for the reset email to arrive. A batch of 31 messages download onto the handset, my password reset email being the last one to arrive. Nobody is missing these people yet. Nobody has accessed this account for days. I reset through the email link and choose the password G650. It seems apt. I hold my breath. I wait for it to confirm. It works. Now only I can access their emails. I scroll through the emails. The Google banner at the top of the page reads, "This page is in Russian. Would you like to translate it?" I click translate. I read. Most of them appear to be statements or receipts of some sort. Some are meeting itineraries, locations, times, and people. Some of the emails are spam. Funny that criminals get spam too. But none of the emails seem to be personal. No names in the emails. I see Aegis Consultants referenced a couple of times. Another corporation, Karwinen Holdings. Transactions between the two. Another called Themis Financial Management. I stop reading. I need something more. A person's name. Something. I commit a few of the company names to memory. I'll look them up later. I delete the emails created by my password reset and sign out of the email account. I clear the browser history on the hotel PC and sign out of the guest page. Now, text messages. I'm pretty sure I'll find something in the text messages. The green message icon shows there are 42 new messages. I don't think I've ever had more than 10 unread texts in my life. But then I suppose these guys aren't alive, are they? That can cause an unnaturally high build-up, I'd imagine. I tap on messages. The phone has no saved numbers, so the messages all appear under phone numbers. I Google them. The plus one codes, America. Plus 44 codes, UK. Plus 7 codes, Russia. Plus 352 codes, Luxembourg. And a plus 507 code, Panama. The Luxembourg numbers text chain seems to be mainly written in French and German. The Panama text chain is in Spanish, with the occasional English word cropping up. The American and Russian numbers seem to be purely English. Whoever this phone belonged to spoke a lot of languages and had a lot of balls in the air, so to speak. I tap on the first message, the most recent one, the American number. I read the chain. They have agreed. They will expedite the transaction. Safe flight. Information not received as advised. Is there a problem? Where are you? Contact me. This could turn ugly. Advise. I go back to the message menu. Choose the next message chain down. The Russian number. Meeting location set for today. Pickup set for 22:30 at heliport. Flight redirected? What is your current location? Is there a problem? Can we assist? They did not receive. Where are you? Where are you? We need to talk. Respond as soon as you receive this. Respond. Suddenly, A dotted typing icon appears underneath. Oh my fucking god. Shit. I forgot about the Wi-Fi connection. The three grey dots blink up at me. Someone is there. And then I remember. Remember that iPhones send red receipts to the sender unless you specifically change the settings. And these messages have been marked as red. I scramble to turn it off. What if they've traced everything I've done? What if they find out who I am? But they can't. There's no camera in here. I've used a public computer to read the emails. Anyone in the resort could have done it. There's no way they, whoever they are, could know it's me. But what if they're coming? What if they come here and review the CCTV footage and see me coming in from the lobby at this time? I know there are security cameras in the lobby, in the hallway. Shit. Okay, but realistically, Erin, realistically, even if they know where the email account was accessed from, it takes at least a day to fly to Bora Bora from almost anywhere, a full day. And then they'd have to break into the hotel's security system and view the footage, and then they'd have to figure out it was me from that footage. Would they do that? They don't even know I've seen the emails, do they? All they know is that their text messages have been read. I need to read what they've written. I need to check. I inhale deeply and push the power button again. White screen, Apple icon, home screen, one unread message. I tap it. Where have you been? They don't know I'm not whoever it is. Should I type something? Should I? Maybe I should tell them I found the bag. No, I don't think that would be a good idea, no. Maybe I should pretend to be them, should I? It would stop them looking for me, right? Send them off on a different track. Oh God, I wish I'd thought this through before. I can't think straight now. Okay, think. Think. The three grey dots appear again. Shit, I have to say something. I tap on my text box, the text cursor pulsing. Three grey dots will be appearing on his screen now. He'll know there's definitely someone there. Someone on the other end. I type. Redirected flight. Unavailable for transaction. That seems okay, right? Fairly opaque. That should buy us enough time to get out of here before someone comes to find us. I press send. Gone. Off into the ether. That seemed okay. Yeah? They might think the plane people are lying low or something. Right? And then reality hits me. Lying low? What the actual fuck, Erin? What the actual stupid fuck are you doing? Lying low is not a thing. This is not the third man. You have absolutely no idea what you are doing right now. You are a film school graduate on your honeymoon. They will find you and they will kill you. You are going to die, Erin. And then something very, very bad happens. Another text. Who is this? The grey dots pulse. Pulse, pulse, pulse. Oh no. I stab the power button on the phone. Oh God. On the way back to the room, I try to think of a good spin on what I've done. Some way to put it to Mark that doesn't make me sound like a liar and an idiot. But to be honest, at this stage, it's fair to say that I am both of those things. I just want his help. I'm scared. I need him to help me fix this. Chapter 18. Wednesday, September the 14th. Aftermath. You did what? I stare at him. What can I say? Are you completely insane? Why on earth would you do that? Why did you lie? These are real people, Erin. Real dead people and real living people. We have no idea who they are or what kind of resources they have. I cannot believe you could be so stupid. Why? Why did you do it? I say nothing. I just stand there. I know. I'm an idiot. He's perfectly right. But we do need to fix this now. That's all I care about. I just want to fix it. I don't want to die. He slumps down on the sofa. We're in the lounge. I called him over as soon as I opened the door and told him everything. The companies, the emails, the texts, everything. He sits there thinking, frowning, his mind racing. All right, he says finally. Okay, Erin, what does he know? I shrug, shake my head, I don't know. There's no way of being sure. No, think about it, sweetheart. Stop and think about it. What does he know? He says it slowly, deliberately. I swallow, take a breath. He knows someone other than the plain people have the phone? That much I'm sure of. Great, and what will he infer from that? He says. That we stole the phone, I suppose, that we either killed them or robbed them. They seem like the two most probable explanations. I look up at him. He nods. So he's going to want to find us, isn't he? He says, thinking it through. How can he find us? Through the phone signal? Or through where we access the email account? They're the only links, I say. Okay, so the hotel computer room, and how will he know it's you on the computer rather than anyone else in the hotel? I see where Mark is going with this. The CCTV footage in the lobby and hallway. The time codes, me walking towards the room, away from the room, before and after the access time. I shudder. Shit. Even though there weren't any cameras in the business center itself, I'm still on film going in there for anyone to see. We need to get rid of the footage. I notice my sudden jump in logic, from making a mistake to actively committing a crime. Just like that. I wonder if that's how it starts for a lot of criminals. I wonder if that's how it started with Eddie. A mistake, a cover-up, and then a slow, inevitable chain of events. Nothing like this has ever crossed my mind before. The impulse to get rid of the evidence. I have no idea how one would even go about getting rid of footage. It's never occurred to me, of course, because I'm just an ordinary woman on her honeymoon, and aside from going over 80 on the motorway sometimes, I don't even consider breaking the rules. Maybe in my mind sometimes, but never in reality. So that's the only link to you personally, is it? That CCTV footage. Aside from that footage, it could have been anyone in that room on the phone, on the computer. Mark gives me an encouraging smile, not too much, but enough. Yes, that's the only link, I assure him. We go for a walk. We have no idea where they might keep the CCTV monitors and recording equipment, but we head for reception. It's a pretty logical assumption that it will be in the room behind the reception counter. If not, we'll have to keep an eye out for a security guard and follow him back to wherever he goes. The plan is simple. Of course the plan is simple. We're not actual criminal masterminds. If there's no one on the desk, then I'll slip into the back room, find the video system, and delete as far back as I can. It can't be that hard, right? If I can delete a whole month, so much the better. Cover our tracks completely, why not? If there's someone in the back room, we'll have to go with plan B. There are two receptionists at the desk when we reach the main hotel. Mark takes my hand in his, and we approach the lobby. He holds me firmly and leads me on towards the library room. Plan B it is then. Plan B is I have food poisoning, and Mark wants to make a complaint. Hopefully, we'll be ushered into the back room so we can check if the system is in there. If it is, we'll need to get rid of the receptionist for a minute and deal with the footage. It's not foolproof, for sure, but I'm a film grad and Mark's an unemployed banker, so cut us some slack. Look sick, he whispers. I tilt my head back and inhale noisily through my nose. I put my hand to my head and exhale slowly through my mouth, like someone desperately trying to hold it together. I look around for a seat. Mark plays the concerned husband. Where do I want to go? What do I need? I am silent. I am pale. It must be bad, my illness. I sit gingerly down on a chair outside the hotel library. One of the receptionists glances up at us, reads the situation, She throws a look to her colleague, who is slightly older, maybe her senior. The older woman nods. You can deal with it. Then dips back into her paperwork. The younger receptionist makes her way over. Here we go. My part here is easy. I just need to look distant and breathe deeply. Mark has the hard work. He starts before she makes it to us. Excuse me, a little help here would be great if you're not too busy. His tone is curt, tight. He's going to be difficult. A difficult customer. The receptionist breaks into a dainty trot in order to get to us faster. Behind her, the other woman, who can clearly see a shitstorm brewing, gathers up her papers and quietly heads off down the opposite corridor. I bet they get a lot of arseholes here. Sorry, sir, is everything all right here? Her tone is warm, an American accent. Mark looks annoyed. No, actually, no. Everything is not all right, to be honest with you. He squints at her name badge. Leela. I see her sigh inwardly and steel herself. Credit to her, she keeps smiling. My wife and I are meant to be on a 5-star honeymoon, but we've been shut up in our room now for 2 days due to the food poisoning you've decided to give us. I don't know what kind of outfit you think you're running here, but we've had just about enough of it. This Mark is a genuine arsehole. I'm so sorry, sir. I wasn't aware of the situation. The issue hadn't been brought to my attention, but I can guarantee you now that I will sort this out for you and we'll make sure that whatever needs to happen, happens. I appreciate that, Leela, and I know it's not your fault as such, but you should have been informed, really, shouldn't you? I raised the issue yesterday and no one has got back to us. Nothing has happened. This is supposed to be a luxury 5-star resort, and I honestly don't know how you manage to get those stars if you A, don't communicate with each other, and B, ignore customers' complaints when they don't suit you. It's disgusting. Look at my wife, Leela. Look at her. His voice is raised now. It's very loud. I think we can officially call this a scene at this stage. Leela looks down at me. Somehow I've started to sweat. It's probably the stress of our plan, but I'm guessing it looks pretty damn convincing. I stare up at her dazed. She makes a decision. Sir, if you'll just come with me, we'll go somewhere a little quieter, and perhaps I can fetch a glass of water for Mrs. Leela's doing really well. Extremely professional. God, this is a good hotel. Seriously? For Christ's sake, Leela, Roberts. It's Roberts, Mr. and Mrs. Roberts. Bungalow 6, Jesus fucking Christ. Mark exhales loudly through his nose, a man contending with himself, staying just the right side of exasperated. Mark's good. If the banking doesn't work out, he could always be an actor. Mr. Roberts, of course. Well, if you would just come with me now, I can make sure we get this all handled for you. Let's get you something to drink, Mrs. Roberts. Leela beckons us to follow her. Mark hoists me tenderly from the chair, supporting my weight, his hand bracing me under my armpit. We follow. The back room is bigger than I'd imagined. Open plan. There's a door just off it that Leela leads us through, into a plush, well-appointed meeting room. A special complaints room? More likely, the VIP check-in room, for high-profile guests, the people that other people might want to stare at. I'm getting used to this world now, how it operates. We sit. Leela turns the blinds on the windows that look back into the back room slowly. As they close, I catch sight of the black and white CCTV monitor, and then it's gone. She sits down in front of us. Okay, first things first, Mrs. Roberts, can I get you anything? An iced water, something sugary, anything at all? I try to speak, but nothing comes out. I clear my throat. It's been a while since I've said anything. Big build-up. I nod. Thank you, Leela. I really appreciate it. I rasp. A good cop to Mark's bad. Poor Mrs. Roberts. Could I get a hot tea, please, Leela, with sugar and lots of milk, if it's not too much trouble? Is that all right? I peer up at her, apologetic. Sorry to be causing a problem. Leela looks relieved. A friend, an ally. This might all have a positive resolution after all. She might get some great feedback later. A thank you letter. Employee of the month. She smiles. No problem at all, Mrs. Roberts. I'm going to go and fetch it myself. Please just make yourselves comfortable, and I'll be back shortly. She checks for Mark's approval before swishing out the door of the VIP check-in room, through the back room, and out into the lobby. The door shuts behind her. I jump to my feet and run out of the VIP room and into the back room. Mark stands in the meeting room doorway watching me. I get to the CCTV monitors in time to see, on the screen, Leela round the end of the lobby corridor, off on her way to the bar. On the computer screen, I minimize the windows and find the archived days. 60 days kept footage. Should I clear it all? No. Just ask stay? No. A month is fine. I highlight mid-August to mid-September and click delete. Am I sure I want to erase these files? The program asks. Yes. Yes, I am. I click. I then go into options, erase trash. Done. How are we doing? I click on the minimized screens. No sign of Leela yet. My heart is thundering. I go back into the program, scroll through the options. There it is, settings. Keep files for 60 days. I change the settings to 6 days. That should muddy the waters. By the time someone checks the archived data, they'll think it's a settings error. No one watches back hours of CCTV footage unless they're looking for something. I check the screens. There are no cameras in this room. We're fine. I return the screen to its original setup. Still no sign of Leela. I want to do one more thing. I scan the room. Have you done it? Mark whispers, urgent. Erin. Yes, but one more thing, one more. Then I see it. A filing cabinet across the room. I check the screen. Leela is leaving the restaurant bar, cup and saucer in hand. I've got less than a minute. I sprint across the room, dodging chairs. I yank open the R drawer and flick through the files. Roberts. There it is. I reach in and grab our passport photocopies, our address forms. I hear heels tapping loudly across the marble lobby. Shit. I slam the cabinet shut and sprint back to the VIP room and dive into a chair. I shove the papers down the front of my shorts, and Mark sits beside me as Leela opens the door. She enters with a warm smile. Here we go. Nice hot tea. She peers at me, concerned. I'm breathing pretty erratically now, due to the running and the adrenaline. I look terrified and sweaty. In a way, I look perfect. I wobble to my feet. I'm so sorry, Leela, but I really need to use the restroom again. Which is the nearest? I implore breathily. She puts the peace offering tea down and instantly gives me an understanding smile. I suppose we've all been there. Just next to the library on the right. We'll be in here when you're done if you're up to it, Mrs. Roberts, she adds. What a nice lady. I will leave feedback. As I stagger out, hand lightly placed on the front of my shorts, I hear them start to duke it out over our imaginary grievances. Well done, Mark. Keep it up. I waste a good 10 minutes in the bathroom, soaking the papers, then balling them into mush. I deposit them into separate sanitary disposal bins before heading back to our room. Chapter 19. Wednesday, September the 14th. Lynx. Eventually, Mark bowls back into our suite, full of energy. Done. He plops down on the sofa next to me. I let my head fall onto his shoulder, exhausted from the waiting, from the tension. I think we're friends again. Fight or flight stress endorphins have healed the rift I made by using the iPhone earlier. We're a team again. The Robertses versus the world. Great work. I breathe into his shoulder. I kiss it softly through his t-shirt. How did you leave it? I ask. It doesn't really matter. I just want to hear the sound of his voice, the vibration from his chest. I already know he will have played it flawlessly. Very well, thanks. Leela and I are best friends. She's given us a letter for 2 free nights in any 4 seasons we choose, and I told her she was a credit to the hotel, and we'd be passing that on to the manager. She seemed pretty pleased in the end. He kisses my temple. You did great, Erin, he says, tilting my head back to look up at him. Seeing you like that, with the CCTV. I've never seen you like that. Can't believe we managed it. You got our IDs too, didn't you? I didn't even think of that. You did great. So great. He bends to kiss me. Those were the only links to us being here. If they come, if they even come for us, the important thing